Bow, 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 bow. Thank you, Duane Eddy. Welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station. This is the 195.1 FM and, of course, 1080 AM radio for over 50 years. Can you imagine that? You know, I was driving along Highway 3 and I was thinking, someday I'm going to have somebody else drive and I'm going to write down the names of all the places that were not there when I first came to Northfield, Minnesota. Then I'm going to do that on Division Street. And then, of course, talk about neighborhoods that were not around. And I'm thinking about the southeast part of town and the northwest part of town. It has grown so much and so many new things to me. And, of course, been there forever when somebody moves into town, like my guest, who's in again for the third time, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like you to welcome Charlie Coogan and Coogan. Coogan is better than Coogan.
Well, Coogan's Irish, and that's a great name.
Yeah.
But my dad got Coogan.
Coogan. And what is that? Scottish?
No. They probably didn't speak very good English. They came from Russia.
Uh-huh.
And I think they were forced off their land, and so they ended up coming to New York City. And they came through Ellis Island, like so many others.
This is your great-grandfather?
My grandfather.
Oh, wow.
So I think he came in 1910.
So you're a second-generation American.
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, my grandfather, on my father's side, came from Russia. He went to night school and for about 8 years and got a dental degree from Brooklyn College.
Yeah.
And then practiced dentistry for a long time. But, yeah, he wasn't a native English speaker.
Now, you travel all over the world. By the way, Charlie Coogan is a guy that works for a place called Crimson Education, and we're going to talk about that. But you travel all over the world and sit in airplanes and sit in airports. And I remember when I was young, flying was an experience that you looked forward to. And you just walked up and you say, give me a ticket to Chicago, and you paid them in cash, and you took off, and it was fun, and they gave you a meal and refreshments. And now it's wait, and then get in and squeeze yourself into a seat and wait to get to where you're going. I don't know. Do you enjoy flying now as a man that's almost 60?
I enjoy flying, but the domestic flights can sometimes be challenging because the amount of room you get is modest. And you have to buy a meal if you want to have a little snack. And I suppose they do give you nice peanuts.
Yeah, they do.
Or pretzels. But, yeah. But that, you know, it's not much for 2 or 3 hours in the air.
I think they might even quit peanuts because of people that are allergic to peanuts.
Right, right. And, you know, that is – so I like it. And I like international flights because
– why?
I can usually find a movie I haven't ever had a chance to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Or bring a good book that I haven't had time to read.
Mm-hmm.
And for about 8 or 10 hours, there's nobody there to tell you you should be doing something else.
You know, I think the nicest flight I've ever had was from Paris to Chicago.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, maybe it was to the Twin Cities. The plane was not full.
Right.
It wasn't even half full. And the you don't say stewardess anymore. And you don't say waitress anymore.
Right, yeah.
You got
a flight attendant.
Flight attendant. Yeah. And because it was a huge plane, probably a 747, and you could lift the armrests and lay down, get a blanket, and sleep.
Right.
Oh, man, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then I did have one ride back from Hawaii. Actually, it was to Hawaii in first class. That was nice. But the flights lately, the airport I hate most is Las Vegas.
I've never been to Las Vegas, but I'm assuming.
You've never been to Las Vegas?
No, but I'm still only 60, so maybe I can go next year.
I mean, you've been all over the world, and you haven't been to Las Vegas?
I figure if I'm going to see a pyramid, it's kind of fun to see it in Egypt. But.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Well, anyhow, the airport, McCarran Airport, mm-hmm. I remember flying in, and you got off the back end, you know, the tail end of the plane, and walked into the thing, and got a cab, and away you go. Now,
then you're in the world of luxury. So yeah.
Yeah. Now you got to go get off the plane, walk through the elevator, and walk here. And, terrible. Yeah. Just terrible. Yeah. Anyhow, that isn't why we're here. We're here to say good morning to you. How you doing? I haven't seen you since yesterday.
Right, right. It's been a long time.
All my troubles seem so far. Every time I say yesterday, I want to sing that song.
Right, it's a good song.
Well, let's. Where do we leave off?
Well, we were talking about Carlton and basketball, so I got excited and went and changed into my basketball clothes and played noonball.
Did you really?
Yeah, well, and now I can't lift my right arm, but it was fun for a half hour.
I've met a lot of people that go to there and play noonball. As a matter of fact,
sure.
my wife's niece is married to a fellow from, not Bermuda, but one of those islands mm-hmm. out there.
Sure.
And he's a minister, and he lived in Faribault before he moved to Florida, the family.
Right.
And he would come up from Faribault to play basketball at Carleton.
Yeah, it's when I was a student, I'd play.
Yeah.
And I got to play with some of my old professors. I think there was a guy named Pat Dust, who used to have a mean jumper, and a guy named Neil Lutzky, who threw a lot of elbows. You know, there were all of the coaches would play. It was a kind of a nice bunch. Lauren Soth was a trooper. He was one of these guys who I think played well beyond the age that I'm at right now, and he was an opportunist. You know, he would just wait for his moment and then pop up the jump shot when nobody was looking. So so it's kind of nice to have that kind of chronological diversity on the court, because you get good mentors in the process.
One of the things that I also remember, and I don't know if it still goes on, but you know Marv Grundhofer, the former mayor on two occasions? Well, he used to go there and play handball at New. And the Monty Irwin is another one that played handball. And there were quite a few in the community that would go play handball.
In the stadium, I bet.
Underneath there. And when I was a kid in high school, I played handball, and we didn't wear gloves.
Right.
We used our hands. And,
right.
And boy, I'll tell you, until you get them all calloused and roughed up, it hurts.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's a good sport.
Yeah.
My brush with greatness was in 1980. My job was to open up the stadium at 7 o'clock on Sunday mornings, but I was at an age where I usually stayed out late on Saturday nights, and the people who would be there first in the morning were Michelle Monroe and Paul Wellstone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they would always call security and complain that the guy wasn't there yet, so I'd get dragged out, and I'd come and open it up by 7:30.
Well, but I remember Paul Wellstone and I were on Bridge Square, and there were a lot of people gathered there because Michelle Monroe walked someplace to fight a particular disease.
I think Parkinson's, yeah.
Yeah. Remember that? Well,
yeah,
were you here when he did that?
I wasn't here. I was in Chicago at the time,
mm-hmm.
but I remember following it. They had an article about it in the Carlton Voice.
Oh, I heard it on KYMN.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see, if I'd known, I would have been right on there.
Of course, streaming was not around at that time.
Right.
So we're getting together. By the way, one of the questions I wanted to be sure to ask you, and I didn't forget, this is amazing, and that is, as a student coming here from Kirksville, Missouri,
right?
After a group of relatives that attended Carleton,
right.
You decided, okay, that's where I'm going to go. When you came here, what year was it when you first started?
I got here in the fall of 1978.
Oh, okay. Now, what were your thoughts about Northfield community, like you're involved now, as a Carleton College student? Did you pay attention to that, or was it a unit all by itself over at Carleton where you just hung with your buddies?
Well, one of the things that makes it easier to get involved in the town is that I think I'd been here 3 or 4 days, and then the defeat of Jesse James Day celebration started. So you have to come off your hill and come into town. And I remember having a great time. And I'd never realized you could have a rodeo this far north. I mean, they had them all the time down in Missouri, but you don't think of Minnesota as rodeo country.
Yeah.
And so I think that got us into the community. Plus, We never had cars.
Did you watch a raid reenactment?
Yeah, I did watch that.
Well, then I like to say that I was riding at that time.
Really? Okay.
I was Frank James.
Okay.
So now, what about places like the Rubenstein?
Yeah, the Rubenstein was wonderful. Of course, it's not running right now, but we'd come down and have food. When I'd come for reunions, my parents always liked the Rubenstein. They just thought it was a neat name, the good food, the Reuben sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
So I ate at the Rubenstein before I was a student.
When I
had a little money, I'd come down there. I didn't always have a lot of cash in my pocket.
Okay, and what was your relationship as a student at Carleton with the students at St. Olaf? It used to be kind of fun, a little victory battles, rather, between the two, the bonfires and the raids and the beanies and all that. What was it like in 78?
You know, we didn't get the beanies, which was nice. I was happy not to have those. But I've heard stories from talking with Bob Flotten that they would sometimes get together after games and taunt each other and then throw each other into the Cannon River off the bridge.
Yeah.
Never was that exciting. I think when I was at Carleton, people would come to see our games, but they weren't quite so intense about it. So I knew some Olies when I was a student, and we'd eat dinner, especially at St. Olaf when I stayed over the winter break for basketball, because the dining facilities were shut down at Carleton. And I made some good friends, a few good friends, not a million, but a few good friends. And then if you went down to Marty's, you weren't going to ask if the person you wanted to dance with was a Carl or an Ole. You just asked them to dance.
Oh, I remember being a townie.
Right.
I remember many a night at Marty's.
Yeah.
And I asked Marty to join me on the air, and he said okay, and I pursued him, and finally he says, Wayne, I just don't want to do that. And I said, okay. By the way, guess who I ran into at Fair Foods or what? Whatever it's called.
Family Fair.
I like to shop there, by the way. I'll give them a little plug. And they have fresh meat counter now with seafood. Pretty nice place. Guess who I ran into?
I'm not sure.
Bob Sullivan.
There you go.
I said, hey, Bob, I heard your name on the radio yesterday. He was coming in. I was going out.
Right.
And there were people in back of him and people in back of me. And so we didn't get to converse. He just turned around and said, why? And I said, oh, next time I see you.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Now he's interested. Maybe he'll be on today listening.
Well, I hope so. It's 9:15 on KYMN Radio. And speaking about 9:15, I have to talk about my friend over there at the quarterback club.
Sure.
Dale Finger and the crew, and Steve and Laurie Eastrom, the morning crew, and talk about all the great food that they have. And one of the things that they have that a lot of listeners and a lot of my guests enjoy is the roasted chicken is a gimme, but the flame broiled burger specials that they have like five different specials, and then that includes fries and a drink, and it's less than $7 or just a little over. And they're flame broiled burgers. Every time you eat one and you have them for a while, you go, that's right, these hamburgers are really good. And they're not overly big, you know, where they're sloppy. They're just delicious. The Quarterback Club on Highway 3 and 3rd Street, family owned, and you are invited to stop in for breakfast till 10 Monday through Saturday. And of course, on Sunday, they don't have breakfast. Do you know why, Chuck?
No, I don't.
Because a lot of nonprofit organizations have pancake feeds and the egg deal feeds, and he said, why not let them have that business on Sunday morning to help their cause.
So sure.
Thank you to the QB, located on Highway 3 and 3rd Street in Northfield. We're talking to a gentleman by the name of Chuck Coogan. And he graduated from Carleton College in 1970.
I graduated in 1982. By the skin of my teeth. You know, they have a final project, and I had to redo it, but
no,
it turned out okay.
In 1982, your mom and dad were living in Kirksville.
Right.
And you owned a home.
You know, at that point, we rented a home.
Okay.
And it was a nice big house, but with six kids, we needed a lot of space.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, they did buy a house.
Okay. I was going to say, 1982 was a bad time to buy a house.
Right.
Interest rates were up to 21%.
Right. I think that was what they...
That's why they rented.
They rented, and I think early on, and I think you may have found this with other people, early on, I think when my dad came to Kirksville, Missouri, mm-hmm. he thought this was a stopping point and that he'd be on to somewhere bigger and better later. And then what happens is you end up in a small town and you start to make connections and you start realizing that the quality of life is really good and you know your neighbors and there are reasons to stay. And so he finished his career there.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned that because I have talked to people that said, boy, this Northfield is a snooty town. It's hard to get to know people. And I said, all you have to do is if you're religious, go to church.
Right.
And boom, right away, you are going to have a lot of people you mm-hmm. know. Number two, join the Lions or the JCs in the old days if they were younger, and the Rotary Club
right.
or Sertoma, and then you'll get to know a lot right. of people. Go down to the local pubs, and you'll get to know people. And, you know, it isn't like it was when I first came, but even further back, the townie and gowny thing was,
right.
you know, kind of a... I'm a townie. Oh yeah, and you aren't. You're just a gowny.
Right.
So that kind of is over with.
I think those lines are blurred now. I think it's because a lot of the faculty are townies
mm-hmm.
at the two colleges. A lot of the staff are townies. A lot of the people I worked with in the admissions office were the women who worked in the office often had husbands who worked in town, and they were farmers, but they were also the wives of bank presidents. You had kind of a nice
yeah.
free flow between the college and the...
Who are you thinking of when you say a wife of a bank president?
Well, I was thinking of Nan Shumway, who then opened up her own dog walking business. But
okay.
she was at Carlton for years. And
that'd be Dave's wife.
Right, right. Yeah. And she was she was really bright and good yeah. at her job, but also had so many connections yeah. in town that you would get to know people in town if you ended up running into her
yeah.
at the grocery store. She'd introduce you to somebody else. And so I think... It doesn't take too many degrees of separation to get to know people.
And, of course, they're from the First National Bank
sure,
in Northfield. Once again, let's go around. When you go to Family Fair,
right?
You know, you go in there for a gallon of milk, and, of course, like all the marketing experts say, put it as far away from the front door as you can so you have to walk the aisles.
Right.
I went in there yesterday for a gallon of milk and some half and half. That was on my... pickup, okay? You go through there, and you have to walk all the way to the back, but I grabbed a little basket. I ended up getting a bunch of stuff, ultimately, so I
right.
went and got a
so
car.
So it worked.
Yeah. That's what I told the manager.
Yeah.
I said, hey, that it's working.
Who says a psychology degree is not worthwhile, you know?
But the fun part is, every aisle, you run into somebody you know, and you chit-chat.
Right.
And that is so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
And you take somebody, let's go to Maplewood, for example, and you mm-hmm. go to the grocery store. It's like you go in there, you get your stuff, and you go out, and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, I'll tell you what, getting through Family Fair takes a while because there's so many people that you run into.
Right, right. My job now is from home. Because I said, you know, we'd had some reasons why it would be good for me to be at home more than I had been in the past. But I like talking to people, so sometimes I'll just create an hour of open space and head into town, and almost everywhere you go, you'll run into a friend and have a conversation, and it kind of gives you that energy that you need to go back and then sit in front of a computer screen and do your job.
Yep, I couldn't do that. What did you do upon graduation, and who was your commencement speaker?
Wow. Commencement speaker, when I graduated, does anybody ever remember that?
Only one I know, and that's John Fossum.
Right.
And the reason is he had Walter Mondale at high school.
Yeah.
He had Walter Mondale at from wherever he graduated, St. John's maybe.
Right.
And then he had Walter Mondale when he graduated from law school.
So every year he just...
So he remembers the commencement speaker.
I don't know who my commencement speaker was, but I remember we had the Friday convocations at Carleton, and I remember going and listening to Bella Abzug, mm-hmm. who was a pretty outspoken politician. I remember there was a famous poet named José Luis Borges, and he gave a beautiful presentation in Spanish, which was then translated for him. And I remember some great convocations, but for the commencement speech, I was in sort of a bad mood because I graduated with an asterisk. And so my grandmother was there, and so I said the asterisk means special honors, and they have to keep the diploma so they can put gold stars on it and things. And she said, well, right here it says it's because you haven't finished your graduation requirements. And so, you know, they have something called COMPS, and COMPS is a big research project you're supposed to do with a faculty member. And I changed advisors right in the middle of my junior year, and I didn't quite pull off the COMPS the way I thought I would. So I still had to rework on that when I was...
COMPS?
Comprehensive exercise. It's usually a big paper, but it could be a big exam.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is it gets you ready for the next step. If you go on to graduate school, you'll be a little bit more prepared for independent research. And so I did get a chance to write that paper. It took me about 6 months, and I presented it in December and did get my gold star and my diploma. But in the meantime, I think at graduation I was just sort of grumpy. Because everybody else was getting a real diploma, and I was getting an empty.
You know, KYMN Radio broadcasts that deal.
Yeah, it's often. I mean, I've heard some great speakers. One of my classmates spoke last year, Kathy Hudson, who is the deputy director of the NIH, National Institute of Health. Jimmy Calker has given talks. I mean, there's some really interesting people who've given talks.
I used to go
up there. Amy Klobuchar a few years ago gave a talk. Really,
I would hook the microphone up. And run the cables and lines,
right.
And I would engineer the broadcast. And I actually broadcast everything, mm-hmm. every name, every graduate.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
I'd say the whole thing, and I'd sit under a tree, a shade tree, and just lean back and listen to the commencement speech and to make sure everything was working. It was a lot of fun, a great way to spend a Saturday.
Yeah, it's really fun. I used to have to wear the cap and gown, which is not as fancy as some, but I found it was a little warm inside those caps and gowns.
I liked what some of the people wore under those, you know, and the sandals and stuff.
Sandals and shorts and,
So you graduated in 1982, and you majored in...
History.
You wanted to be a history teacher?
No, you know, I just loved history.
Yeah.
I don't think I was thinking about what I wanted to do. And I studied history. I studied political science, and I studied languages. I studied French, Russian, Danish, and Latin, and realize that I'm not very good at studying languages if I'm sitting in Northfield, Minnesota, doing verb conjugations. But if you send me to where the language is spoken, I get better at it.
So okay.
I found that when I studied abroad, I actually learned fast.
So what was your first job out of Carleton?
First job out of Carleton was doing investigations for a lawyer in my hometown in Missouri, because I still had to finish that research project. And then when I finished that, I went into the Peace Corps.
Did you do you still have the typewriter that you used?
No, I don't have the typewriter anymore. I think I sold it for about $5 so I could have a little money to buy my first computer.
Yeah, all your work was done on
a typewriter.
Typewriter.
And in fact, they started selling a lot of lap or desktop computers while I was in the Peace Corps from about 83 to 86. And when I came back in 1986 to go to graduate school, everybody had a computer.
Now, let's talk about the Peace Corps. That's something that Kennedy started, I believe.
Right, right.
And the idea was to go to foreign countries and help dig wells and organize and bring some aid and give an opportunity for foreigners to appreciate and understand American young people and their thoughts and feelings. Is your grandma
you? No, but there's a guy who died today who also helped Sergeant Triver to start the Peace Corps.
Oh.
And his name was Wolfert. Russell, I think it was, I don't want to say his name because I'll get it wrong. No, I didn't, but I just thought it was fascinating. I read the obituary in the New York Times, and he was a fascinating guy. He got a lot of the adult senior volunteer programs going.
Okay.
He was Mr. Volunteer.
So you signed up for the Peace Corps from Kirksville?
Yeah, I'd gone to the Peace Corps recruiters talk at Carleton, and I'd studied abroad twice, so I wasn't worried about living overseas, but I wasn't sure if what happens, the Peace Corps has to write job descriptions that will get through Congress, so they tend to sound very bureaucratic and administrative and maybe a little dull. And then what happens is when you get in the field, you have to then take that job description and translate it into reality. And that was fascinating. But reading the job descriptions, I was almost a little put off. It sounded like you're going to be going all the way to another country and then doing a job that sounds pretty bureaucratic and dry. And it couldn't have been farther from the truth, but I think that's just the way they had to write them to get approval from Congress. So I remember reading the job descriptions and thinking, maybe. And then what happened is I graduated in 82, and I don't know if you remember, but the economy was not exactly booming.
We just said that.
Right, in 1982. And so by 83, I had a few different opportunities, but the Peace Corps seemed like a good one. And I followed up and did interviews in Kansas City because I was living back in Kirksville at the time. And the recruiter, I think, made it sound a lot more interesting than those job descriptions had sounded. And I did put in the application and got recommendations.
And what's your commitment when you first?
It's 2 years.
Two
years and about 3 months because I was doing an agricultural project. So they did 3 months of training, and then you started at the beginning of the agricultural cycle.
Where did they train you?
They trained me in Houston, in Huntsville, Texas. Did you ever watch that movie Stir Crazy?
Probably.
With Richard Pryor.
In jail.
And Gene Wilder.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yeah. Well, that's the prison where they had the bulls or steers.
Oh, yeah?
That they were supposed to be riding. And we ended up training some of that herd for plowing. They were plowing oxen. So you had to get a yoke on them. And they weren't always so excited about that. And then you had to get them to plow in furrows, you know, using this kind of appropriate technology. And then we had agriculture courses. I grew up in a small town, so I did work on farms as a kid to make some money, but I never had a farm of my own. And my usual title was, hey, you, get over there and buck that bale. So it wasn't necessarily, I didn't have the visionary side of it, but I had the hands-on.
So they're teaching you how to walk behind?
No, well, they're teaching you, what we were doing is in Togo, farmers are not stupid, so they'd actually begun to try to work with tractors, but when the oil crisis hit in 79-80, the price of gas got so high that your average subsistence farmer, there's just no way they could afford to use it. So they began looking for ways of using the livestock that they had already to plow, because the traditional farming system was plowing by hand, you know, almost like a bunch of gardeners out there with hoes, and maybe you'd only have a small plot of, you know, maybe 5 or 10 acres. And the idea was that you had to get everybody in the family out there in the field working because you didn't plow very much. And when the idea of using tractors fell through, they went to the next step and said, you know, a lot of these farmers have their own oxen. So if they were to yoke those oxen up and then get a good moldboard plow, like we used to use back in the day in the United States, it's a sort of a halfway point. You know, you go from not having every single kid in the farm, and then they can't go to school, and the girls can't finish elementary school because they all are needed in the farm, to having a pair of oxen that can do a lot of that work, and the kids can go to school. You know, it was a good idea, and the farmers were not foolish, and so a lot of them, just like farmers let's say in Canada, they had great tractors and they didn't have them in Minnesota. The farmers are going to get over to Canada and get those tractors and bring them home, right? But then maybe when you need to replace the parts when they break down, you're having to make some real juggling to get your replacement parts. So it turns out the United Nations built a factory that built these pretty simple plows, and we got a credit system, so we could go to the farmers in each village and find those who seemed to be pretty on top of things, and we had extension agents that we worked with, and we actually placed a lot of pairs of oxen with the yokes, with the plows and replacement parts with a credit package, and the reimbursement rate was almost 100%. So it was a great project, but it was mostly because the farmers were pretty proactive. They were looking for ways to do better.
And you were in Togo.
I was in Togo. But we did our training in Huntsville, Texas, and that was actually interesting. It was hotter in Huntsville, Texas than it was in Togo.
Well, you had to feel comfortable, Kirksville, Huntsville. And now we are going to take a break, mm-hmm. And then when we come back, we'll learn where is Togo.
Togo.
Okay. Right after this timeout.
Here's to the defiant ones, the roughnecks and rogues, who refuse to live by the laws of physics. And here's to the renegades who go 0 to 60 in 4.4 seconds, but wish they were doing it in 3. Introducing the 2018 Can-Am Maverick X3. With 172 horsepower, 24-inch of suspension travel, and an aggressive 72-inch stance, it's tailor-made for anyone looking to give gravity the bird. Head to Leo South in Lakeville to unleash your inner Maverick today.
The affordable one, the one you want at Leo South.
We sell one.
We sell fun. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair, 9:32 on a Wednesday. Today is the 23rd day of January, and the year is 2019, and we have light snowflakes falling on our Division Street parking area. Right now, we're going to find out where my guest was in the Peace Corps, and Charles Cogan is my guest, and where is Togo, T-O-G-O. It seems to me I've heard that name.
If you look at the map of Africa, you get up to Spain and you kind of see Morocco below it, and then it kind of curves around. It's called West Africa, that whole region in the area. And then there's a chin underneath where you sort of come around almost like a big letter C, and then you see a chin. And you've got Nigeria over anchoring the corner of that chin. And then as you go around, you've got Benin, which used to be called Dahomey. Then you've got Togo. Then you've got Ghana. Then you've got Ivory Coast. Then you've got, you know, Guinea and Senegal. So it's right in that sort of chin under.
Okay, so now we know it's in Africa.
It's in,
and on the west side.
On the west side.
And it's next to Nigeria.
Near Nigeria, not far from Ghana, not far from Benin, right in between.
And you think of Nigeria, you think of Rascals.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, because of the, you know, they rip people off all over the world when they call and say, I need you to go to the Target store and get a card. The Togo, what type of a political atmosphere did they have in 1982-83?
Well, they at independence had a pretty interesting visionary leader named Silvanus Olympio, who was, they called them Afro-Brazilians. He actually was from a family that had been involved in trade along the coast. And he had an education in French, but also spoke some English. And he had a kind of a plan for the country that didn't go with what the French had in mind for that region of Africa. And that was an area that had been a part of the French Empire for about 80 years. And so the French, well, on radio, I don't know, but I think there's pretty good evidence that French backed a military coup that got him out in 1963. He was actually killed. And then that military group put in power a couple of civilian presidents who didn't have a lot of influence, and eventually the military said, why should we just do this through proxies? And so a former sergeant from the French Foreign Legion named Eyadema, E-Y-A-D-E-M-A, took over in person and ran the country for 39 years.
Wow.
And when he died in 2005, his son, after some initial back and forth, took over and has been there for another 14 years.
So nepotism was important.
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, the country has gone through some ups and downs, and I think the economy has not taken off the way it might. But
you said French Foreign Legion, right?
Yeah.
You know what I think of when I hear French Foreign Legion?
A book called Beaugest?
No, I'm not that educated. I think of Abbott and Costello.
Okay.
And being over there, and being in the French Foreign Legion.
I can imagine, sure.
And wearing those goofy hats. And,
yeah.
Saw the movie, and that's what I remember. Then I heard that it was really a tough army, the French Foreign Legion. Yeah.
They were tough. In fact, what was interesting is a lot of the officers who did the coup in Togo actually had served in Vietnam up until Dien Bien Phu, when the French were defeated. And so the French drew on their colonial empire to have all kinds of troops from around the world.
So Togo was to the French a place where they had exported food, minerals?
Yeah.
Why did they want Togo?
Phosphates. It's an interesting... We won't go into it now, but it was originally a German colony, because in the 1880s, the Germans were working along the coast of West Africa and trying to find a foothold, and the British were installed where Gold Coast is, Ghana, and they were facing a big empire called the Ashanti, which was pretty powerful, and the British couldn't make a whole lot of headway, but they had control of the coast.
They wanted colonial lines?
They wanted to, and then the French were facing Dahomey, which was another powerful African empire, and not making much inroads. The area between Dahomey and Ashanti, you know, the Gold Coast was open. So the Germans kind of got a foothold there, signed a treaty with a fairly small king of a beautiful lake on the coast, and then claimed everything behind it. You know, it was a little bit like the scramble for the American West, where you'd have people signing treaties, and a lot of the African leaders would sign a treaty with the French, and then they'd happily sign another treaty with the British. You can never have too many friends, and these were supposed to be treaties of friendship. And then they would sign a treaty with the Germans, and then eventually what happened is the French and the Germans and the Belgians and the Portuguese and others got together in Berlin in 1884 and did the Congress of Berlin, where they sort of divided up Africa according to some pretty arbitrary lines, and a lot of those lines are still national borders, which is one of the challenges in that region. But so that's as far as I'm going to go with that.
Well, evidently at that time, the interest in Africa was agriculture and, of course, minerals in that regard. So they wanted to go in and colonialize those countries, and the people at that time were probably not familiar with the warfare that the French and the Germans and the English had.
Right.
It was rifles against spears or something like that.
Or it was machine guns, Gatling guns,
yeah,
against muskets.
Okay.
So it was a pretty bad imbalance. Okay. The history of that region is a terrible one.
Yeah.
There was a lot of trading of human beings for better guns and all these kinds of things going on.
Is that the slavery?
The slave trade, right. And that region is right in the heart of it. What ended up happening is that some of the northern, it's hard without the geography, but if you go a little further north, you got something a little bit like medieval Europe, where you've got, you know, cavalry. And cavalry are really good for charging battle if the people fighting you don't have machine guns, but they're certainly not very good when the opponents have machine guns. So the Germans were able to take down a couple of major kingdoms because the kingdoms would charge with their beautiful cavalry and then just get mowed down by the Gatling guns, a little bit like the charge of the Light Brigade.
Mm.
Whereas in the Ashanti region, in the center of Ghana, the Ashanti were well-armed, partly because of the slave trade, but they were well-armed, and it was forest region, so that it would be a little bit more like guerrilla warfare sometimes, and the British had a heck of a time trying to defeat them. And the Dahomeyans also were pretty well-armed, and so it was not ever a given up until about the 1890s that the Europeans could actually take full control of those regions. But the Togo area didn't have those sorts of big kingdoms. They had a little bit more smaller politics. Beautiful land there.
Were they inland, or did they have...
They have a beach. The beach is beautiful, okay. And actually there's a beautiful port in Lomé, which is the capital city now, and that's one of the other big sources of income, is that the landlocked countries in the north. There's something that used to be called Upper Volta, but now it's called... Burkina Faso. There's another country called Niger that sort of borders on northern Nigeria, but doesn't have any port. A lot of those countries will send their things to the south. The ports in Nigeria got a little bit complicated because of issues of corruption, but also, you know, there's a lot going on in Nigeria. It's a huge country. It's a country with a lot of inequity, but also some brilliant people. Togo was smaller, more manageable, so a lot of truckers would drive down through Togo. There was a national highway, and that was a safe port, relatively, where you didn't have to pay quite as many bribes, and you pretty well could export and import. So that one of Togo's big strengths for a while was that they had a stable government, partly because there was a military dictatorship. They had phosphate on the coast that was actually, I think they were the fifth biggest phosphate producer in the world, and that's needed for fertilizer. And they did have some other resources in the country. At one point in time, there was a socialist government in Ghana. There was a socialist government in Benin. There was a socialist government in Burkina Faso. So all the countries around were socialist governments with leaders who I think had good-hearted attempts, but sometimes those kinds of things are hard to really implement. A lot of the middle class would then take all of their money and all of their products and ship them through Togo because they felt they could get a better price for things. And so Togo became a leading exporter of cocoa, even though they don't have really much cocoa. They became a leading exporter of gold, which Ghana has a lot of, because I think people who had access to the gold would rather sell it through Togo to the French and get a good price than sell it through some of the other governments. So it was an interesting thing. So for a while, they really benefited from having a stable, although not very democratic, government. And when I was there, that was what was going on.
Well, you talked about bureaucracy on this end. for you to be trained and expected to enforce these ideas so Congress would pass the dollars to you.
Right.
But when you got there, it was kind of thrown out because it was real basic, and that is, how can we plow and grow crops?
Right.
And so was it a political thing in the early
At that point in time, the Peace Corps tries not to get into politics, and so at that time, even if you thought the government was a little tough on the people, you just did your job. And I think the idea is that if you're sending Peace Corps volunteers in who are then going to start meddling in politics, it becomes so complicated.
Yeah.
So what we did is we tried to work with our counterparts and do the best we could to bring the services that we could bring to the farmers.
How many were with you in regards to working?
Togo had a big Peace Corps population, maybe 100 and some volunteers in Togo.
But they were all over the country.
All over the country. I was in the furthest north. I had French from my bad French from when I was in an exchange program, and then I kept on working on it so that it got up to mediocre. So my French was actually pretty good compared to the others. And so they started teaching me African languages. I started learning Gorma and Moba and some other languages. And so they said Charlie could survive in a pretty remote outpost. And so they sent me to the far east of the northern part of the country.
What was it like? What was the topography?
You know, in some ways it was beautiful. I lived in an area that had some little mountains around it. And then you came down into this kind of a valley. And I was in the valley. And so when you drove, it was a little bit of a, I mean, there were market trucks that would tip over because the roads were so rocky and things. And that was always a tragedy. But the area was beautiful. I mean, you had hills and valleys, and during the rainy season, it became bright, beautifully green and lush. The problem is that the rainy seasons were a little bit unpredictable. It was a little further north. It was getting closer to a drier part of Africa. So in a good year, the farmers had great harvests and did really well, and in the bad years, you didn't have regular rainfall, and sometimes they'd be suffering. And part of that might be due to deforestation. So there were a lot of projects trying to get people to plant trees and get that sort of retention of soil and prevention of erosion going. I'm not an agronomist. I did 3 years of agriculture, and I think I did an okay job of absorbing what I needed. But you know, there are brilliant people around here who could talk in better depth about the need for sustainable agriculture. And
in that outpost that you were in, how many Peace Corps workers were there?
It was just me in the
just
village.
You?
It was in the village that I was in. It was just me. And I lived in a little house right next to a mountain. And a little house. It was a mud brick house with a zinc roof, and the idea was that the zinc roof would keep the rain off, because sometimes when the rains came, they were pretty torrential.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mud brick was because it's more affordable. And I had a couple of thatched huts. One was a kitchen, and one was a shower. And during
connected.
No, they were right next to the house, and a lot of times in the hot season, it was so daggone hot, I would just move my bed into the thatched hut because it breathed better.
Mm-hmm.
Inside a zinc, you can imagine a zinc roof, you know, it got pretty daggone hot in there.
I can't imagine that.
It got hot, yeah.
So what was the crop?
The main crops, there were people growing corn, but there were different varieties that worked well. This was called the Savannah region, so it's a little bit, maybe not quite like Minnesota, but it's a little bit like Kansas. You know, there was a lot of, you know, so you had corn, different varieties of corn that worked pretty well. You had sorghum and millet. And if you know sorghum, have you ever had sorghum molasses? It's a sort of a sweet thing, but there was sorghum, and people would make a local beer out of that. And it was actually pretty tasty. And then you had peanuts and black-eyed peas and all the kinds of things, soybeans, the kinds of things you'd...
And how many acres?
Well, the average farmer might have 5 to 10 acres, and so it wasn't huge farms. And part of it's the technology that they were using was pretty much hand farming. Eventually, as you started getting farmers buying the plows and the oxen, they could plow more, and so you would have some consolidation where a farmer who wasn't doing too well might just say, yeah, take my land and give me a little percentage. And the other farmer would do the farming and all that. Or you had farmers with the oxen would rent out their oxen for a day to go farm somebody else's land. So you're starting to get a little bit more differentiation.
Like combining around here.
Right, a little bit like co-ops. And you did have some co-ops, too. I mean, the farmers are not fools. They were doing what they could with the means they had.
Now, did the farmers that had 10 acres... grow sorghum, and the next farmer over here grew corn, and that farmer over there did the soybeans, and that one over there did
What happened is you had extension agents who were promoting different kinds of crop varieties, a little bit like when you have Syngenta around the corner in Northfield out in Stanton, mm-hmm. and they're coming up with new varieties. And so, for example, as things got a little drier, the national extension agents would come in and they'd promote, you know, a corn called La Posta, and that's supposed to get you through a dry period better. It doesn't die off. And so you'd have things like that. But a lot of farmers had their own sort of native crops that they just kept a little bit of the harvest every year and used it the next year. And so you would have a lot of the same crops because the soil types were very similar. So you'd have your grain, you know, your corn, your sorghum, your millet. There were some farmers doing some crop rotation where if you do corn and sorghum and millet this year, maybe next year you do the beans, and then you try to let you harvest the beans, but you let the leaves and things kind mm-hmm. of go back into the soil to enrich the soil. There were people who did different rows of crops. So, for example, you had some problems with insects, but they found out if you did corn here and then you did beans in the middle and then you did corn, the insects had a hard time making that transition from one plant to the next. You know, so they were trying. I think, you know, some of their traditional methods were pretty smart and pretty good at avoiding different kinds of insects and
well,
things
now,
like that.
Were you there to provide ideas, or are you there to physically do the labor?
The thing about this project, we got to Togo in 1983. Our money got there in 1984. And so for the first year, the guy who ran our project was a former volunteer who had been chosen to run the transition into this federally funded project. And he took out a loan, personal loan, and we worked with a very small budget to work with farmers. So in each village, we would be able to choose one farmer as a sort of a pilot farmer, and they would get the credit. And then as they reimbursed, we could equip other farmers. About a year later, the United States invaded Grenada. There's a Clint Eastwood movie about that. And all of a sudden, Togo was on the Security Council, and Togo abstained from condemning the United States invasion of Grenada, and our money came 2 days later. So suddenly, we had a lot better resources, and we could equip more farmers and things like that. So who knows what discussions took place then, but we actually suddenly could get out and help a lot more farmers. And the farmers faithfully reimbursed. I think the reimbursement was over 95% on their loans. And then
from America.
Well, from America, which were routed through the Ministry of Rural Development in Togo. So I think it was a success, not because of us, but because the farmers were like farmers are everywhere. They were smart, and they were working hard to make the best of their land.
We're going to come back and continue the conversation. We are talking to Charlie Kogan, and we will be back in a flash and learn more about Togo, T-O-G-O.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Let's rodeo! The Cinch, world's toughest rodeo, presented by Ram Stampedes, the XL Energy Center. This Friday and Saturday, the stars of pro rodeo, Whiplash, the Cowboy Monkey, and Saturday night only see CMA artist Travis Denning in concert. Come early for pre-show fun. Tickets start at $20 and kids are half price at Ticketmaster.com. Like us on Facebook, save $5. The Cinch, world's toughest rodeo, more than an 8-second ride.
The Northfield Area Chamber of Commerce would like to congratulate Aurora Pharmaceutical, this year's Business of the Year, Chris Canelli, winner of Business Person of the Year, and Lynn Ziegler, the Chamber Ambassador of the Year. All three awards are very well deserved, and we thank you for all you do for the Northfield community. If you would like to offer your congratulations in person, tickets are still available for the Business Recognition Banquet on Thursday, January 31st from 5 to 9 at the Grand Event Center. Go to northfieldchamber.com for more information and to reserve your seats today.
Well, let's go to Togo once again, ladies and gentlemen. Peace Corps, started by the late President Kennedy, and in 1982, after graduation from Carleton College, my guest Charlie Kogan joined the Peace Corps and went over to help them grow various crops, and Grenada happened. And when Grenada happened, what was the attitude towards the, are they called Togogians?
Togolese.
Togolese attitude towards the American that was with the Peace Corps there, you.
Well, one of the things is that the average farmer in northern Togo didn't really listen to world politics as much. So I would say that the first question people would ask me is, are you French or German? Or if they heard that my French wasn't too good, they'd say, you must be German. And then when I'd say, no, I'm American, I won't say you had a completely fresh start. But a lot of times if you got into the towns, people would all remember former Peace Corps volunteers and say, oh, I remember I used to know Monsieur Jules, you know, and he was, you know, the teacher in the high school. And so I think there was a little bit of an American presence, but we weren't directly involved in the politics in Togo to the extent that we might have been in Latin America, for example. You know, that was a time when in Latin America, if you said you were an American, you would have a strong response. Let's say you were a Peace Corps volunteer in Nicaragua or something. In, you know, Reagan and the Sandinistas had a few times when they squared off, and it would have been a little difficult to be an American in a village there. In Togo, you didn't have that sort of awareness of conflict.
No, because it was on the coast. Did you enjoy the beaches as a white man in an African nation?
The place that I worked was the furthest north in the country, so I was about 600 miles from the beaches.
Oh, okay.
So when I got down to the capital city, I would go out to the beach once in a while, and there were a few nice little beaches. I mean, the beach right next to Lome was mostly fishing. There were a lot of fishing boats out there fishing, and I think there wasn't, you know, it was a little bit of a rough surf to be swimming in. You ran a chance of getting swept out to sea.
Ooh.
Then there were a few little coves. There was one called Robinson's Beach that was actually a beautiful little cove. Mm-hmm. And you could go. I went a couple of times swimming there, and it was beautiful.
Did Togo have lakes?
Togo had lakes in the interior of the country.
Go fishing, go swimming.
Yeah, there were some. There were also a lot of ponds, and a lot of people did water catchments mm-hmm. so that they could grow fish and raise fish in their ponds. And so I think you had some big lakes, and some of those lakes, though, became sources of electricity. So there's a giant sort of lake river in Ghana that became a hydroelectric pot plant. And then
sold that to Togo then?
Yeah, it supported the whole region.
Yeah.
It was the Volta River.
When you're a single young man, Caucasian, what did, you know, when you weren't hooking up yokes on oxen or checking the ground to see if that soil would grow sorghum or whatever, what did you do? You're the only guy there. There's no other Peace Corps people there.
It would seem to be a really big challenge. My local language skills were pretty lousy at first, but you had junior high school in town, and so you had all the students at the junior high school in the town there who all spoke French. You had the teachers from the junior high school all spoke French. You had the extension agents who I worked with who all spoke French. And so even when my local language skills were pretty bad, I still had friends, and I could sit, and they brew this local millet beer that tastes a little bit like mead. If you've ever had honey wine from the Vikings, it's tasty, and the water often is not so great because there are some problems with water contamination. So when something's been boiled for 3 days mm-hmm. to brew the local beer, a lot of times what you'd do is you'd get up early in the morning and you'd work really hard in the fields, and then by about noon it was just so daggone hot that you would go and sit under what they would call a kind of a gazebo somewhere, and women would brew millet beer. And you could sit and talk, and so you could maybe get through the worst hours of the sun from about noon until 3. And then when the sun started weakening again a little bit, you could get out and finish off whatever you'd been working on. And then the evening came, and in that village, it was actually kind of a nice place. And there were a few of the teachers who had little kerosene refrigerators so they could chill a cold beer for you, and you could sit and talk. And it was a good chance to get to know people. And then as I stayed longer and got better at the local languages, then I could actually get out and talk to the farmers, although my first few speeches were pretty bad.
What about wildlife in Togo, in the area you were in?
The area that I was in was on the border of a game reserve, and as I went through my 3 years, I started working more in the extreme east, and there was a big game reserve where you had baboons and warthogs, and a little bit to the south of where I was working, you had elephants, and they would come, and I remember seeing elephants pretty close up because they would come up to houses.
Were they a nuisance?
Yeah, they were. Yeah, people, if they were given the chance, would have gotten rid of the elephants, but because they were protected by the game reserves.
Did you ever see anybody use fire and chase elephants at night when they were coming in to take
right.
the crops?
Right, they did have to do things to keep elephants out of the crops, and so they would do things like
noise and fire.
Right, try to get them to turn around and go back the other way. You don't really want to piss an elephant off, though.
No.
They would,
and some didn't succeed.
Well, and I had friends who worked in elephant zones, and they said that sometimes you just had to get the heck out of there. Mm-hmm. We had motorcycles, and the motorcycle could outrun an elephant, but there and in the more populated areas, you didn't have too much trouble. But in the areas that were a little bit more isolated, you did have, I mean, baboons would come into a place where there weren't many people, and then, you know, they're pretty strong.
Oh, I wouldn't mess with a baboon.
Well, what happened is, interestingly enough, somebody told me, he said, if you ever have a problem with a baboon, pick up a long stick and point it at them, and then they'd run away.
Oh.
So I guess they're not stupid either.
No.
They thought you had a gun, but it was, I didn't run into that many, but I did run into, you know, places where you'd see a herd of elephants or something, but they weren't a part of my daily life.
Part three of the Charlie Cogan story coming up at 10 o'clock. We're going to take a break for the news. What about bugs and snakes and spiders and all those?
Yeah, all those things that we love so much.
Yeah.
You know, they, when I first got to Togo, there we stayed in the north in a place that had lights, and the lights attracted these ginormous beetles and things. I mean, there were bugs that were bigger than anything I'd ever seen before. And so you just stayed away from the lights. And at night, sometimes it was a disincentive. If you wanted to read a book, you had to run the chance that you either got screens for your windows or you were going to have things flying around the light. So in some ways, people would end up putting a light a little bit further away, and all the bugs would congregate there. And then you'd sit in the afterglow of the light so you could actually have a conversation.
They had electricity on the
In the village I lived in, they didn't have electricity. They had kerosene lamps and things like that. In the capital, in each of the regional capitals, so the place that I lived near was called Dapong, which means New Market. And they had electricity, so they had cold beer and all the amenities of life.
But running water?
Not running water, yeah. There was running water, but I would say you had to kind of maybe be a little careful with it, just because it would go through phases of potability. So what we'd sometimes do is you'd have these little tablets you could put in the water to make sure it was it was cleared up.
You didn't boil it?
Yeah, you could. I mean, I used to buy milk from a local herder, and I would always boil that before I'd drink it. So I'd boil it and then put it in my coffee in the morning. It tasted pretty good. It was really rich.
Off of goats or?
Yeah, this was cow milk, but I did have goat milk once in a while. There were people who made local cheese, too, that was delicious. But I would usually eat it when it was fried. If it was deep fried, you was safe. But if it wasn't pasteurized or anything, so you really wanted to make sure it had been cooked.
I am going to take a break for the news. All right, Charlie?
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Cogan, my guest on the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station. This is The One, 95.1 FM and 1080 AM radio, broadcasting live from our studios on Division Street at 2nd in downtown Northfield, Minnesota.
Minnesota News Network, I'm Tasha Radel. 7th District Congressman Colin Peterson is breaking ranks with fellow Democrats, saying the way to end an unnecessary government shutdown is to give President Trump money for a border wall.
I don't know that I want to give him a blank check, but I don't want to preclude him for getting the money either if he's going to use the money correctly, and we get the other stuff that we need on the border.
But Peterson adds, I don't know how you get there because the White House hasn't called him. And he says fellow Democrats kind of look at me cross-eyed when he tells them what he thinks. As Minnesotans struggle with child and elder care costs, Democratic lawmakers at the state capitol are touting a paid family and medical leave plan for this legislative session. Representative Lori Halverson of Eagan says the plan will provide
12 weeks of paid partial wage compensation for medical leave, including pregnancy, to Minnesotans. We want to provide up to 12 weeks of partial wage replacement for family leave so that Minnesotans can take care of themselves or a loved one.
Supporters of the plan are calling for a state-administered paid leave insurance program that Minnesotans would contribute to and benefit from. Similar proposals have passed in 7 other states, but have run into resistance from Republicans installed here at the state capitol. Stu Laurie is the unofficial winner in a Democratic primary for the special election in Minnesota Senate District 11. Laurie beat DFL-endorsed candidate Michelle Lee by a 53-46% margin in Tuesday's vote. The seat opened after his father, Senator Tony Laurie of Carrick, resigned to become commissioner of the State Department of Human Services. Laurie will face GOP State Representative Jason Rarick and legal marijuana now candidate John Sparky Bierenbach coming up in the February 5th special election. This is MNN.
Doodly-doo-dee-doo-bum-bum. When I get old and lose my hair. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio. Something very interesting happening right now as we look out our big picture windows, or whatever they're called, and we see the sunshine. As a matter of fact, almost have to pull the shades, and it's snowing out. But it's not windy. It's just falling gently. And it's like the snow that you would want on Christmas Eve with the moon. What do you think? Charlie, you're the sun is in your eyes.
That's good.
Yeah. Are you okay?
I'll live.
Okay, but isn't that weird? The sun is in your eyes, and I should pull a shade probably.
Well, right? Sun is better than smoke, right? They used to say smoke gets in his eyes.
And then smoke gets in your eyes, they say. Yeah, okay. So at 3 before after 10 o'clock on KYMN Radio, the Wayne Eddy Affair, once again my guest Charlie Cogan, and we're talking about his years as a volunteer for the Peace Corps. And the word volunteer generally means no pay, but how can you live a couple of years in the Peace Corps without compensation?
The way the Peace Corps does it is they give you whatever your local counterpart would make. So if the principal of the local junior high school is making $200 a month, they figure he's probably living pretty well, so they'll give you $200 a month.
Oh.
So I got about $200 a month.
What'd you do with that money?
I bought food, and I bought gasoline for my motorcycle, and I bought clothes once in a while, usually at secondhand markets, and you know, sort of lived fine.
Into the major city?
Right.
What was the big city next to your village?
The next to my village was called Dapong, which means New Market.
Yeah.
And it was about 40 miles away. But the capital city is a city of a million or two, and it's got a few skyscrapers, and then you got the fancy stuff. But yeah. Usually you get better clothes in the secondhand market.
Motorcycle, what kind?
It was a Yamaha DT100.
Okay.
Which is not much. It's got a big body.
Yeah.
And a really little motor.
Yeah, it gets you from here to there.
You could go about 70 kilometers an hour comfortably. And
which
then
is about 50.
Right. If you tried to do much more than that, you're going to be in trouble.
I took a motorcycle trip from Austin to Tomah, Wisconsin on a Honda Scrambler 160.
Right.
Never do that again.
I can imagine.
That's a long ride in a narrow seat.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true.
So anything ever exciting happen over there? Did you listen to the radio? Did they have television? What newspapers did get to your place or New Market?
Right. They did have radio, a lot of radio, and there were some pretty big stations. There was one called Air Africa that it would give you good music. So a lot of people would get a little radio, and then they could at least listen to music in the evening. And a lot of it was fun.
Was it all in French? Or?
A lot of it was in French, but Ghana had a lot of good music. And then there was sort of what's now thought of as Democratic Republic of Congo. There were some really good musicians who sometimes sang in Portuguese,
mm-hmm.
because Congo itself, Angola, speaks Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
But then there were also things in French, a language called Lingala. Some beautiful music. There was an artist named Franco, who was really famous and whose music sounded almost Latin American. But there's been a lot of traffic back and forth between, you know, Brazil and Argentina and Colombia and that part of Central Africa.
Now, when you say Ghana, for some reason that sounds negative to me.
No, Ghana used to be called the Gold Coast because there was so much gold there. But Ghana.
So they overworked the people in the mines and underpaid them and almost forced labor?
Well, no, there could have been some of that. I think one of the things that you have is a lot of migrant labor. So, for example, the north has a dry season, and during that dry season, you can't do anything productive. in terms of farming unless you've got irrigation, and most of the areas don't have it. So you've got about a 4 or 5 month period where you would just be sitting around drinking at home or something. So a lot of people from Togo, Burkina Faso, Niger, some of the countries further up north, would work for half the year on the cocoa plantations and other things in Ghana, Ivory Coast, and some of those countries. And I would say that there was probably, anytime you've got guest workers, there's always, you have a little bit less rights and there might be a little bit of abuse, but they wouldn't get workers to come if they weren't being paid. And so I think there was a fair balance, and a lot of people from Togo, especially early on, Ghana was wealthier, and so they would actually settle in Ghana. And at some point in the mid-60s, there was a, you probably heard of Kwame Nkrumah. He was a president of Ghana who was a big visionary. He studied in the United States.
I remember him.
And then went back. He said, Africa must unite. And so he was pretty welcoming to guest workers. At one point in the mid-60s, the economy got a little tighter in Ghana, and he was overthrown. And the next guy who came in was a guy named Kofi Buzia, who said, get rid of all the visitors, get rid of all these foreigners.
That's why I have that negative feeling
right, and
about
so
Ghana.
Ghana did reject a lot of people from Togo and Ivory Coast and Nigeria, got kicked out and had to go back home, often without a lot of what they'd saved up and all that. But it didn't help, because it turned out that you actually often benefit from having people from other countries. So a lot of the financial sector was controlled by Nigerians. When they were kicked out, they took away all their know-how.
There's so, Nigeria again.
Yeah, but you know, Nigeria is a country of contradictions. You've got some brilliant people, and you've got some people who aren't so good, you know.
When you say Ivory Coast, I'm thinking a Gulf Coast, but you seem to refer to it as a particular united country. What is it? Is it the coast that they call the Ivory Coast, or is it a...
So Gold Coast had a lot of gold, and Ivory Coast had a lot of elephants at one point in time, and so a lot of the world's ivory came out of different regions, but that was one that was famous for the quality of the ivory. And then ivory has been on the bands.
But
band
you're talking to a region when you say the Ivory Coast.
If you think of that under chin, so sort of, I'm showing it to you like a C, and it sort of goes like this and then goes down and then goes around. And so there's South Africa down here. There's East Africa over by Kenya and all of that. In West Africa, it's almost like New England. You know how there's such little states now?
Yeah.
So you've got Vermont and New Hampshire and all these little states that kind of go like this.
Yeah.
They're like teeth, just going one up. And so you have a lot of states along the border on the ocean that are fairly not huge states, but they kind of stack up one after the other. And Ivory Coast was a French colony for a long time, although they've had plenty of history before that. Then you had Ghana was Gold Coast, which had some British connections, although the Ashanti held them at a distance for a long time. Then you've got Togo, which was just in between and didn't have major kingdoms, although they had a few little ones. Then you had Benin, which is just, and they're all sort of like Vermont and New Hampshire, just sticking up one after the other.
Yeah.
About 8 years ago, three of the five countries that made it to the World Cup for soccer were in that region. Togo went, Ghana went, and Ivory Coast. So they're stacked up one next to the other.
Yeah.
And so in this huge continent with so many countries, three of the top teams were all right next to each other.
Wow. As a young man, at that time you're 22, 23 years old.
23.
What about social life, dating, for example?
I got very good advice early on, which was that if you're dating in the village where you're working, it can be a complicated thing.
Yes.
And certainly, a little bit like what we tell the Rotary Youth Exchange students. You're going to a country for a year. If you start dating too much or taking it too far, it can really not be a positive thing, because you're leaving at the end of the time, and who knows what's going on with that. So I think for the first 2 years, I just tried to focus on relationships with people, but didn't do a lot of dating. And I think,
I mean, were there dance clubs or?
Yeah, there were great places to go and have a drink and enjoy dancing.
And was your being Caucasian a problem in regards to social intermingling?
There wasn't much hostility. I think that this is a region, maybe that's an irony, isn't it? Because it's a region where the European countries caused such terrible problems for years and years and years. But a lot of the people who were involved in that ended up in the United States and far away. And so I think there wasn't a lot of hostility. There could have been, for example, in the Caribbean and Jamaica. There's a big awareness of the impact of the slave trade and all that sort of thing.
That's where my wife's niece lives.
Right, of course.
Jamaica.
Of course, yeah, and there's a lot more awareness of that, so you'd have to deal with with people kind of saying, are you a decent person or not, based on, you know, what your country has done over the years. I'm going to assume not until proven otherwise. In Togo, you didn't have to sort of start with a negative. But I would say people were interested. You're from another country. You come from a country that's well-known, like the United States, and people would just want to know more about you. So I think it was always a chance to have some conversations. The thing is, I loved sports. So we used to play. There was one tennis court in the entire Savannah region, but we found it and had a lot of fun tennis.
Who's we?
Well, I found it, and then there were a lot of local functionaries working in town who played there.
Functionaries?
Yeah, people who worked, teachers and directors.
Peace Corps?
Different, no, these are Togolese.
Okay.
There were a few. I got more Peace Corps volunteers involved. There was all a right. basketball court that was in pretty bad shape, but we got a good basketball, and we'd play twice a week. And some of the Peace Corps volunteers would play, but then also local teachers and others who were halfway decent. We actually made it to the semifinals of the national tournament, you know, a couple of times in basketball, and so we had fun with that.
Well,
so
you must have been in heaven, being a bench guy in
right. Suddenly, people would think, oh, this guy must be pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we had soccer. In soccer, there was a team called the Gaillard Club, which is kind of like the, in French, that means like the big strong guys. But it was a bunch of teachers and local medical people and not many Americans for that, because not many of the Peace Corps volunteers were good in soccer. But I was in a village with no basketball court, so a lot of times I would play soccer every day in the village after work just for fun with all the students. And so I got to be, I mean, I was a decent athlete, so I got to be a respectable soccer player. And so I got to join that group, and I played a lot of soccer with them. And usually it would be playing soccer and then going out and having a beer together. So there was some good fellowship. And the nice thing is then you show up at somebody's office on Tuesday looking for a bulldozer for the road you're trying to work on or something. And one of the people there knows you from soccer. So suddenly, instead of all the French formality where you have to go and fill out 97 forms and say, dear important person, I beg you for the honor of, you know, they would just say, oh, Charlie, hey, we had a good game, didn't we, last Saturday? Sure, take care of him. And so I think sometimes the relationships you can build beyond just your official job description can make you much more effective. And what better way than through sports?
Well, I think for listeners that are not from Northfield, that they would be aware that St. Olaf religion is a very important part of their course. Now, with Carleton, we know there's a religious affiliation and a beautiful chapel.
Right.
But I don't have that feeling that Lutheran or what at
right,
St. Olaf.
Right.
What is Carleton?
Carleton has an old affiliation with the Congregationalist movement, the UCC Church.
Yeah, Congo.
And they actually were founded by the same people who founded most of the Ivy League and really good schools across the country. But I think that a direct affiliation was dropped maybe around the beginning of the 20th century. And it's still a cultural influence, but there's a chaplain's council. It's actually really neat. The chaplain is Carolyn Fierce Locum, who is an old classmate of mine from Carleton, but who has done a really good job of bringing all of the religious communities together. So there's the one of the associate chaplains is a rabbi, and she works with the Jewish students, but also does outreach to other communities who'd like to learn more about what they're doing. Then there's another associate chaplain who is an imam, which is a Muslim leader, but who is actually a woman. And she's also really good at, I mean, when there were the Danish cartoons about 10 years ago that got everybody up, and it was really tough. The Jewish students and the Muslim students did joint prayers, which I thought was a really nice way, because Arabic and Hebrew are so close that you can't do joint prayers without realizing all the cultural and historical similarities. And I think that the community at Carleton is not dominated by any one religious group, but it really does embrace that this whole diversity. So you've got Hindu services. There's something that's done every spring where you have Purim, which is a Jewish holiday, along with Holi, which is a Hindu thing where you put paint and powder all over each other and have a nice meal too. And there's a Diwali, which is the conquest of light over darkness. And it's a Hindu tradition that's also pretty close to some of the Persian stuff. And it's a beautiful ceremony, and you bring in dancers, and I think Professor Rambachan from St. Olaf came over and gave a talk about the meaning of this, which he somehow makes sound a little bit like Lutheranism, but it's a I mean, a fascinating evening. And then you really have a nice cultural evening. You have some good Indian restaurants, so we have it catered. So I think by the time you get done with it, you've got a really nice mix of all the different religious communities feeling at least that they're invited to the table.
So then you mentioned all of these religions that are not real popular in America.
Right.
So do the Christians, which would be Protestants, Lutherans, Catholics, Methodists, etc., do they all get into one group and like the other ones you just described?
What happens is the use of the chapel rotates around. So every Sunday, or if you're doing Jewish ceremonies, it would be on Saturday, or if it's Muslim, it's on Friday. And there's some major holidays for each tradition, but they rotate the use of the chapel. So, for example, last year around this time, they had an Ethiopian-Eritrean Christmas celebration because the calendar for the Ethiopian church is different, but the church in Ethiopia is just as old as it is in Europe, older than Europe, because it came to that part of Africa before it came to Europe. And you know, and so you've got this kind of beautiful, rich heritage and really good food catered by an Ethiopian restaurant in the Twin Cities. And you get to hear the songs sung in Amharic, and it's a pretty beautiful service. But then 2 days later, or the next Sunday, maybe you have Native American Catholic. And it's usually something where it's taking different kind of Native American traditions that have become incorporated into the Catholic tradition in their own way. It's pretty neat stuff. You ought to come up.
I'll
get you the program for that, because I'm not a very good anything. I'm not a great Episcopalian. I'm married a Catholic. I'm certainly not a very good Catholic, although I certainly love the community. But I find that this willingness to embrace all the different traditions is really, really positive.
I went to St. Dominic's service last Sunday.
Yeah.
And I am a member of St. John's.
Of course.
And I'm not, I practice as well as you do.
Yeah, practice makes perfect.
Yeah. And they had a Hispanic day.
Where sure.
They did mass in both English and
right.
Spanish, and I remember doing mass in Latin, period.
Right.
And then Latin and English.
And the priest was probably facing the altar instead of facing you, right?
Yeah. And so, anyhow, that's pretty interesting. When you mention these things, I remember when Jesse Ventura, as governor, came to Carleton to give a speech at
Skinner Memorial Chapel?
Skinner.
Yeah.
I told you I'd get those mixed up.
Yeah.
I got to remember. Skinner. And I lined up a broadcast of his address, and I had the cables coming out of the chapel and onto my truck and my equipment. And some guys started crawling around with black, and they had on black ski masks.
Oh, great.
And they're sneaking around. Well, there's bodyguards for the governor. And
so they were not too happy with that, right?
And I'm going, well, what in the world is going on?
Were they bringing out Schiller?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So my question is, explain Schiller first, and then tell me if you ever got involved in it. And that's what they were after, and the bodyguards knew that. They arranged that.
So they were, I think it would be better. Otherwise, you're going to get some people beat up. Yeah. I think
Jesse did not know that.
Bill Clinton pulled out Schiller when he was giving his talk on campus.
And
I think a bunch of people tried to charge the stage,
which
was not well received by the bodyguards. So Schiller is, I think apparently there was a bust of Schiller on the desk of a college president in the 1950s. Maybe that, you know, this is my version.
Okay.
And if somebody's got a better version, they can come on next week and debunk me.
Who was Schiller?
Schiller is a German poet who was from the Romantic tradition. And he had one of the things he's famous for is saying, to the dreams of thy youth be true. So the idea is that you should be true to these romantic ideals and try to make the most of life and, you know, learn the beautiful things. And so I think he must have been a pretty, I mean, I know he was a wildly popular poet. There, he was also a medical doctor. So it's just interesting how you get these different things.
And what era did
this? This is in the late 18th, early 19th century.
Oh, okay.
I should double check that before I say it on radio, but let's Google it next time I have time, and I'll make sure I get this straight. There's another famous German poet named Goethe, G-O-E-T-H-E. They have the Goethe centers around the world. And I think he and Schiller were somewhat contemporaries. I think maybe Beethoven was bouncing around in that period. So there were all these really brilliant Germans and Austrians and others doing this stuff. His bust was on somebody's desk, and I'm thinking of president of the college, and someone stole it. I think I told you last week that there were ways you could get into different buildings through the underground tunnels. That, of course, I never did, but I heard about those things. Yeah. And I think somebody got in, stole the bust, and then would bring it out periodically and bring it to the big stage, and then they'd have an escape plan where they'd climb out the window and throw it to somebody below. And the whole idea was that if you could get away without people taking Schiller away from you, that was a big success.
So was it a group of individuals that was studying his literature?
Maybe it was students in the German department, who were studying German. I don't know. I wish I knew more. Maybe someday the original crew will step forward and denounce themselves. But what happened is eventually your escape plan might not be good enough, and then some other group steals Schiller from you.
Okay.
And then they go into hiding, and they try to figure out when would be the next good time to bring it out. And so then
were you ever involved?
I never touched Schiller. They made these little foam bobbleheads, and I had a few of those, and so I could actually squeeze Schiller, and when I was feeling a little nervous or tense, reading too many files.
Mm-hmm.
But I never got the real Schiller. And I think there's a rumor that maybe that Schiller has been broken a few times. Maybe that's why they call it a bust. And maybe been glued back together with dinosaur glue or whatever they call it, or gorilla glue. And maybe there are a couple of Schillers floating around out there. I think the current president of Carleton has become a scholar of Schiller, Steve Postkanzer. So maybe if you have him on the show, he can tell you the true secrets of Schiller, because I think he gets access to archives that us common folks don't necessarily get to look at.
Well, I was talking to Joe, the PR guy.
Joe Hargis.
Yeah. Nice guy.
Oh, yeah.
And I asked him if he would line up an interview with me, with the new president.
Sure.
And we've been working on it.
Good, good. Yeah.
How many years now? Five?
He's been here for a while, but he's still new.
And he seems like a pretty well-educated individual.
Yeah.
And, you ever meet somebody, you just kind of think that you better be on your best behavior?
I think his father was the mayor of Cortland, New York.
Okay.
At one point when he was a professor there, he was at SUNY Cortland. He became the mayor of the city.
Okay.
And so when the president came to our Rotary Club, he said, this idea of getting involved in your community is a family tradition.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should mention that to Joe. We can get it done.
Right. Why not?
All right. 25 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair. My guest this morning is a fellow by the name of Charlie Chuck Cogan on KYMN Radio. We'll be back with Charles in just a moment.
A home is probably the biggest purchase you'll ever make, and you want to make sure everything goes smoothly. Call me, State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell. I not only offer homeowners insurance to protect your investment, but I can help with home loans too. No wonder more homeowners trust State Farm than any other insurance company. For information, call me, State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell at 645-4545. Providing insurance and financial services, loans are offered through State Farm Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Do you have an old junker car in the garage or on the farm? Call Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300. Get the most cash for your old junker vehicle and have it taken away for free. Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300.
We're back on KYMN Radio, the sun shining, snow falling, and having a good time on this Wednesday morning. My guest is Charlie Cogan, and we are talking about Schiller. And to finish that part of our conversation, was there a group of guys, I assume, that came up with this, and they're a special unit, like Harvard has their little special unit,
or the Yale has Skull and Bones, or something.
Is there a group like that?
I think these might have been different groups. I think there may have been the Keepers of Schiller. It could have been sort of a secret society. But I was a pretty nice guy, and nobody ever invited me to that society, so maybe I can't keep a secret. I think it would be different groups trying to get Schiller, and it waxes and wanes. I know a couple of years ago, somebody took Schiller out on the football team, and people just watched and applauded. Nobody ran for Schiller, and then they finally just got off and left. And so I think, depending...
You're supposed to charge and steal Schiller.
So the whole idea is that it's like saying, look, I got this really cool thing. Don't you want it? And then everybody else is supposed to run after you. And then you have this escape plan where you give it to somebody in a drive-by car and they take off and nobody can get it. And so you've managed to show Schiller and then get Schiller the heck out of there again.
But so it's a fun college prank.
I think so.
Which is, fun. I had a professor on the air, and I don't know which one it was because I talked to so many, that wasn't aware about the eagle on Bridge Square.
Okay.
You're aware of that.
Yeah, we turn it one way or the other depending on who wins the games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, a lot. I didn't know that for years.
Right.
You know, I never paid attention and didn't know that. So, to wrap up the Peace Corps, you had a good time. You had a telephone or letters?
No, we didn't. We didn't have telephones. Communication was difficult, and at some point, I think my parents were worried about me, so they got in touch with Peace Corps in Washington, D.C., and then they reached the country office, who then sent a note up and said, "Call your parents." But a phone call was about $10 a minute, and so I called quickly. They sent things to me. I used to get the World Press Review, but it would usually go to Tonga first in the South Pacific and then come to me 2 months late. So I think when you're in a country like Togo, the lines of communication were sometimes a little frazzled. But now the volunteers have smartphones, and they'll be emailing their friends on a daily basis. And
did you ever go fishing?
I did a little. I mean, I've never been a great hunter, but people used to have these things called a headbreaker, a castet, where they could throw it. It had iron on the end, and you could throw it after rabbits. So I'd go out a little bit with those. And then some people had bows and arrows. And some people, the government, because it was a military government, didn't really want a heck of a lot of people having guns because, you know, that would sort of throw off the balance of power. So the guns were pretty scarce.
Was there ever a moment of fear?
You know, there were moments of worry, but not a heck of a lot. It's not a country that's easy to live in all the time, although I think the people are wonderful. The governments are not, I mean, when you talk about a dictatorship, you sometimes think everything's terrible, but during the stable period for that dictatorship, people just knew better than talk about politics. I don't know if I'm recommending that as a model, but I would say fear might have been one of one of my friends from the Peace Corps who did the same training with me didn't have a very good motorcycle helmet and got nicked when he was driving down the road and fell and died. And he was a wonderful guy. He but his helmet wasn't perfect.
I bet you that was a bureaucratic mess.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the Peace Corps volunteers don't have motorcycles anymore, and one of the reasons is it's a heck of a thing when you send somebody
off.
Did you
wear a helmet?
Yeah, I wore my helmet everywhere. I had more accidents than you can count, and I had a lot of little broken bones, but not usually big ones.
Upon completing your time, and you only hit the...
I did 2 years, and then I was in the middle of a big project for a village that needed a feeder road. During the rainy season, it would get swamped, and you couldn't get through, so they couldn't get their products out. And so I actually got money from the embassy self-help fund and then worked with some of the villages who provided rocks and sand and gravel, and we were able to build a better road with bulldozers and then... maybe some laterite to build it up, and then some little things that they call French, they call them culverts, radier, to get through, to make sure that they could actually get their products in and out during the rainy season. And that was about halfway through that project when my ordinary Peace Corps year was supposed to be over. And my counterparts were doing a great job on the animal traction part, working with the oxen and the yokes and things like that. So I ended up going, "Hey, is that Bill Whirlin?"
No, that's Jim Harrod.
Jim Harrod, who was actually a nice guy, too.
We have a big plate glass window, two of them, here in our studios. We look out over to the library.
We feel a little bit like fish in a fishbowl.
Yeah.
Right. So people are looking at us.
So to finish your thought, did you finish the road?
So, yeah, we finished the road, and then the ambassador, who was just a fascinating guy named Ambassador Roberts, Owen Roberts, came up and inaugurated the road. So we actually got pretty good publicity on the national level because we
national as in Tonga?
In Togo. Yeah,
Togo. Rather.
Yeah, we had the national newspaper there, and we handed off kind of repair supplies, so, you know, pickaxes and shovels and things and wheelbarrows, and basically told the Canton chief that, you know, that now this is their road, but it's up to them to maintain it, which they've done since then.
So do you take that newspaper article and send it back to the Peace Corps in Washington?
You know, they might have it.
To show that, hey, this is working.
Yeah, this is something that's been good.
And, of course, it's written in French.
No, that was that was written in French. We got into the national newspaper for basketball too because we got to the national semifinals. So there was a picture of me without this big belly.
Yeah.
And a lot of hair on my head.
Yeah.
Playing on the team, and it was a good team. We actually could have almost beaten some of the big teams.
Do you graduate from the Peace Corps? Are you minimized in regards to service? Is there a ceremony when you leave?
There's a closing of service ceremony where they try to help you with the adjustment to getting back home. Also, for every month that you were in the Peace Corps, back when I was there, the government would put $200 in an account for you
for every month
that you served that you didn't have access to when you were in the Peace Corps, but it was called a readjustment allowance.
Sure.
And the idea is when you come back, you may or may not immediately get a job and be able to move on, so you don't want to leave people with nothing when they leave their service. So I think I had maybe $5,000 saved up. I came back and went straight to a graduate program because I'd learned some African languages. And I got a government scholarship called the Foreign Language and Area Studies Scholarship to study at Northwestern University to do African Middle Eastern history. So it was actually, and it covered all the tuition. And then the university gave me a really small stipend that covered the cost of a new pair of shoes.
Well, that's kind of you landed in a good place.
I think I did. And I was getting married about that point.
I
met my wife in Togo.
Virginie?
Virginie Nalong.
Did I say it right?
Yeah, yeah. Beaumont Kogan. And
Virginie
so we came back,
Nalong.
We came back to Kirksville, Missouri, and then we headed up to Evanston, Illinois. And we lived in Evanston off and on for about 14 years.
When you introduce your wife to somebody, they don't call her Virginie Nalong.
No, Virginie, well, I would say Nalong is her African name, and that would be an easy one to pronounce, Nalong.
Is that how you do it? Hi, this is my wife, Nalong.
Nalong, yeah.
Nalong.
This is Nalong, and then people say Nalong, and then we'll write it
that
down.
That sounds Asian.
It does sound kind of, it's a French-speaking country, so they add a U-E at the end, so a lot of people would say
Nalong. Nalong. Okay. Yeah,
but it's Virginie. That's her baptismal name.
Yeah. Virginie.
Yeah,
Virginie. Oui, oui. Yeah. Monsieur. So you get home, you got your pocket full of money, you're going to get a doctorate degree?
Well, I was working on a doctorate.
Okay. Did you ever get one, by the way?
I got a master's degree, and I got about half of a dissertation finished, and I realized that you're actually supposed to feed your family, and my family was growing.
Uh-huh.
So I got a job in the admissions office at Northwestern, and for 1 year, I tried to finish the dissertation and work in the admissions office, and it turned out that Northwestern went to the Rose Bowl that year. For the first time in 50 years, and so it was a busy year, so I didn't get a hell of a lot done on the dissertation. And at some point, you have to be realistic, and so I ended up leaving the doctoral program and taking a full-time job that had insurance and benefits.
Could you finish it and get the title doctor?
Well, I was hoping I could finish by the time I'm 60, so I guess I should go back tomorrow and start writing fast.
Yeah, you're going to be 60 this year, aren't you?
No, next year.
Next year, okay. Well, enjoy it while you can.
Right.
In your 50s, young man.
Yeah.
I feel like
a teenager.
We kind of skipped ahead a little bit here, but that's okay. You get out and you got the pocket full of money.
Right.
You got the scholarships. You got the job. And you're going for a master's degree.
Right.
And about African languages.
African history.
And then
language, too.
Okay. So when you get that master's, where can you apply that?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I applied for a PhD. I originally applied for a master's, and somebody came and told me, if you apply for a master's, you're not going to get any financial aid for it because they're going to save their big scholarships for people who want a doctorate. So I wrote a letter and said, I think I'd like a doctorate. So they wrote me a letter saying, oh, good, well, that changes everything. We could actually give you this foreign language area study scholarship to study Hausa, which is a language of northern Nigeria. And it's spoken all across West Africa because the troops in the colonial armies didn't all come from the same region. So Hausa became sort of a language that everybody could speak with each other, kind of like Swahili in East Africa. And
so,
who taught
that?
There was a professor at Northwestern named Morris Goodman, who actually was a pretty fascinating guy, and he taught Hausa. And he spoke it pretty well, and I spoke it decently because I'd learned that was a language. When you traveled 500 miles, you could still speak it, whereas the languages I was learning in the Peace Corps were usually, you know, maybe a 100-mile radius.
Yeah.
And then it would start peeling off to a kinda dialect
like China,
that was harder.
Yeah.
Right, in different regions of China. So my Hausa was pretty good, but it was a kind of a pidgin Hausa that was spoken by non-native speakers. And Morris Goodman taught it more formally, where it was really, it's actually related to Arabic, and it's related to Amharic from Ethiopia, and it's related to Hebrew. It's an Afro-Asiatic language. And it's
type of alphabet?
It's in the Latin alphabet now for when we were studying it, just like English, but historically it was usually written with an Arabic alphabet, which is still phonetic. And a lot of our numbers come from Arabic, even in English. You know, mm-hmm. Threes and things, if you look at them, they're Arabic numbers. But it was written originally in Ajami, which means it was a Hausa language written with Arabic alphabet. If you go to India, there's a language called Urdu, and that's written in Ajami, or even in Persia.
The Arabic numerals.
Right.
1 through 10.
Yeah.
So interesting.
I know, aren't they? I mean,
yeah. Well, that is really smart. And it works.
And I think between the Islamic world and India, that's how Europe got zero, because I don't think that was a part of the European counting system. If you look at Latin, and I'm sure I'll get corrected by somebody, I don't think there's a zero in Latin. And that opens up all kinds of doors for advanced math.
At 23 minutes before 11 o'clock, a reminder, this is Charlie Cogan I'm speaking to. This morning I met with several friends, and one of them gave me two names. And he said that his wife's friend heard me say, and here are the people that I think. And what I like to do is remind people that I think everybody is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I've had people sit down where you're at 9 o'clock and say, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours?
Mm-hmm.
And then at 11 o'clock, they go, wow, that went fast.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, we're in part three with you.
Right.
But I do encourage anybody out there that wants to come on and be on my show. Hey, you're welcome. But if you know somebody like a grandparent, a parent, mm-hmm. a child, a niece, a nephew, a grandma, a grandpa, mom, dad, they're all interesting, mm-hmm. and I'm always looking for guests. I've had well over 1,000 different people on this show,
mm-hmm.
and I would like to have I'd like to have more,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm inviting people just to call K. Wyman Radio. It's in the phone book, but I'll give the number here in a second. And just give me your number, and I'll talk to you, and you can sometimes the people talk to them first, and then they call me back and say, Billy, we'll go on the air. Here's his number. Some people say, here's his number. You ask him. So if you'd like to have somebody you know or yourself come on the air, I'll have an honest opinion. How do you like this show?
Oh, it's a lot of fun.
Okay. Call area code 507-645-5695. I'll repeat that. And just give me your name and your number. That's area code 507-645-5695. If you or someone you know would be interesting, and everybody is, give me a call. Okay, we'll take another break here on the Wayne Eddy Affair. Then we're going to come back and continue our conversation with a very interesting man, Charlie Cogan.
Welcome home to Northfield Manor. On the campus of Northfield Retirement Community, Northfield Manor is proud to offer HUD Section 8 subsidized equal opportunity housing for adults 62 and older. Take advantage of all amenities on campus, including our state-of-the-art theater, Imelda's Marketplace, Fitness Center, Main Street Cafe, walking trails, and more. Call today, 507-650-7332. Northfield Retirement Community. Innovation, choice, tradition.
We're back live at 20 minutes before 11 o'clock with our guest, his name, Charlie Cogan. You're just saying whatever I want, right?
Cogan would be a good Irish name. There's a place called Cogan's Bluff in New York, and that's. But my father is Cogan, and I think it probably came from Cohen, which would be a good Jewish name.
Okay.
Yeah.
You call them back and you say, hey, wait a minute, I want to go for a doctorate. And I'm thinking, boy, there sure are a lot of jobs for that particular doctorate.
Yeah.
And to earn a living, you work at Northwestern, is it?
I worked at Northwestern because we have a son who's 31 now.
Yeah.
Who was one of the big stars on the big state second place runner-up teams from about 2003 to 2005.
And he was a what, basketball?
In soccer.
Oh.
When Ben Danielson coached, and then later on it was Jorge Zuccolotto.
Oh, I know him.
A great coach. Oh, there were some great coaches. They've got good program now, too. And our youngest son is playing now. But at that point, our son was a baby. And so when they saw me...
So tell me about your wedding. Where did you get married?
We did a civil wedding. Well, we originally did a traditional wedding in Togo. And that was my wife's father's idea, and it was not a traditional Christian wedding. It was a traditional animist wedding.
Well, tell us about it, because I know that sometimes when people get married in foreign countries and they want to do it at home on American soil, the choice can be civil, the choice can be Christian, or whatever religion, and the recommendation is don't have two actual marriages. Mm-hmm. Have one, whichever country you choose, and do it all right there. Then come back, if you get married overseas, come back and have a reception.
Right, right.
So how did you meet Nalong?
I think we met several times over the course of my second 2 years in the Peace Corps. And her memory is that I was a little bit of a jerk, so I think I didn't make a great first impression, which sometimes happens, right? And I think one of the first times somebody had told her that I spoke the local language and we were at a pharmacy. So she came over and talked to me like I was a baby and said, "Oh, you speak the local language, right?"
In English?
Well, no, she said it in the local language, and I thought that was kind of patronizing.
Yeah.
I thought my skills were okay. Yeah. I wasn't that bad. Okay. You know, you don't have to baby talk me just to, and so I think I said something snotty like, what business is it of yours? And so she said,
"No, you didn't."
The heck with that guy, you know, and so we didn't talk again for a while, and then I think we met a few other times.
Why would she walk up to you in a pharmacy and say that?
Because I think people had said, this guy speaks MOBA, which is kind of like what I spoke. I spoke Gurma, but they're related. It's like, it's like Mississippi English and Louisiana English. So So she was just kind of curious, but she didn't know me.
Yeah.
So she thought, he speaks MOBA, maybe he can speak like a 3-year-old. So I think when she asked me, she was just asking me like a you speak, you know.
Yeah.
And so I don't know why, but I think I was busy and I said something like, even if I do, what business is it of yours?
Okay.
And I said it in the language. And so we met a few times like that, which was not a great start.
Where did you meet after the pharmacy?
I think we met at the, well, when we actually got to be good friends was at the going away party for a good friend who was a French volunteer, and he was leaving at the end of his service, and he was a really nice guy, a good rugby player, and I'd played rugby in college, and so we were good friends. And we both knew him, but we didn't know each other that well.
And so
during the course of that his going away party, I think we got to know each other better.
Well, is Nalong from France?
She's from Togo.
Oh, from Togo.
Yeah,
okay.
She's from Togo.
Well, gee whiz, tell me about that ceremony.
Yeah, it was an interesting ceremony.
Or do you
have
an interesting dating period, a year, 2 years?
I won't go. Yeah, I mean, we dated for a while, but I think the ceremony, when we finally got together.
You said you weren't. What about the time in the pharmacy to the wedding? Was that a year, 2 years?
Oh, I would say about maybe a year.
Okay.
Yeah. And we.
How did you inform your family of Deirdre? Is that your younger sister?
My younger sister is Deirdre. My mother's my mother's Nancy.
Nancy, okay. Chuck and Nancy.
And then my father is Max.
Mac and Nancy.
Yeah, Max. Max.
Hey, that sounds like something to eat.
Yeah,
Max, I'll have a Mac and Nancy,
Mac,
please.
Or mac and cheese, right? Yeah, Max and then Nancy.
Okay, well, how? Okay,
I didn't inform them very well, and it turned out to be convenient because that year, my mother decided to go off to the University of California, Berkeley for divinity school for a year because she was going to be an Episcopal priest. So she did a one-year certificate program along with a woman named Linda Clater, who used to teach Latin at Carleton, and some other people. And my father took a sabbatical from what was then Northeast Missouri State that became Truman State now. And so they lived in Oakland. So when I came back, they weren't there. They were off in Oakland, and my mother was commuting to the divinity school for classes. Two of my sisters were in town, and I'd worked for this lawyer in town who was married to the local judge. And so what happened is we had done our traditional ceremony in Togo, but it was more just so that her father would let us go together to the United States. And I wanted her to have a fair shake to get to know this country and see whether this is a place she wanted to live. So we came over.
So you married her.
Well, no. We came over, and it turned out that the local judge did a ceremony for us. And then we, about a year later, when my mother and father were back from Berkeley.
Oakland.
From yeah. Oakland, my mother organized it so that we could have an Episcopal ceremony.
Okay.
And so we had one in the Episcopal church. And my father said, you know, I'm not a very religious guy, so I'll see you after the ceremony, and we'll just have a party together.
Did your mother perform the service?
No, but she was there.
She'd gone
to divinity school, but it became complicated. And when you interview her, you should ask her what happens when you go to divinity school.
Okay.
And then the bishop changes his mind.
Okay.
Because she did a one-year program, and when she got back, he said, well, I never liked these special arrangements, but they had such a shortage of priests up in northeast Missouri that he was willing to work with it. But it became complicated because my father passed away. And when my father passed away, he said, why don't you reflect on it? She reflected on it. She realized she could be a chaplain as a lay chaplain and not actually serve as an Episcopal priest.
Well, I'll ask her that question.
Why not?
But I got to get the toga ceremony. I mean, I'm picturing...
in a rural area.
Leaves and funny hair.
It was people.
Hair or headwear and
yeah, it wasn't too much of that. I mean, it was a nice ceremony where there was a big feast.
And what is a feast in toga?
There was chicken and there was beef and there was pork and there were rice dishes and there were sort of dishes that are a little bit like what you think of as polenta.
Indoors or outdoors?
This was outdoors. Mm-hmm. It was outdoors, and then there was sort of nice dancing and stuff. It was a fun wedding.
What kind of dancing?
There was some traditional dancing where people actually put on cowrie shells and dance with the headgear, but then there was also a radio that would play some nice music, so the kids would just get out and have some fun and dance with the music, and so it was just a gathering.
What did she wear?
Oh, I think she wore a traditional Dutch wax print.
Okay, that's what's going to be interesting. Yeah. What is the Dutch wax print?
Well, when you think of the Dutch, they were very involved in Indonesia and in Southeast Asia. And during the time that they were there, if you've ever seen batik, it's these beautiful prints that can be all kinds of different prints, but they're done with a special wax that doesn't wash out easily. And especially in Togo, a lot of times people are washing things by hand with pretty harsh soaps. And so the quality of the cloth, if it was a Dutch wax, that's the highest quality. It means it doesn't fade too fast. You know, you can wash it for years and it keeps its bright, beautiful colors. So she got a nice Dutch wax print that you'll see when you go to an African gathering. A lot of times you have these very bright patterns.
Yes.
And they're Dutch wax. There's also English wax, which is maybe a third of a notch down, but still good. And then you'll have local prints that sometimes if you wash it for a year, it's already fading.
So how does the ceremony go where you are legally married in Togo?
Well, this is not legally
Togo.
Married. So this was more of a traditional wedding where you actually have the father's permission to be with the daughter.
And it
varies, you know, by tradition. In the north,
there's not a minister or
There, it's more of a council of elders who would sort of bless the wedding. And
so you ask the father, I would like to marry your daughter, and he can say no or he can say yes. And if he says yes, you're married.
Yeah. But you'd have to do some ceremonies to placate the ancestors.
Yeah.
There's a sort of hierarchy that goes back a few hundred years that you'd want to make sure that you did the proper ceremonies and services.
Did it take a while?
It took a while. I think it was a three-day ceremony.
3 days?
Yeah, but it wasn't constant work. In fact, I just mostly lounged around and enjoyed it. And I had a matching wax print, which
beautiful colors.
Yeah, they're actually beautiful colors. Yeah, they're beautiful colors. And then what happens in Togo, for New Year's, for example, you don't have as much of an exchange of gifts as everybody gets matching outfits. And it's a really nice, good quality outfit. And then for the next year, you've got this really nice, beautiful outfit that you can wear.
What do you wear normally?
You know, there's a lot of secondhand clothing stores. So, for example, I was able to buy Carlton t-shirts, not usually Carlton t-shirts, but I could certainly get Michigan t-shirts or Minnesota t-shirts because there are thousands of them out there. And when they get bundled up at the Goodwill and people have picked through and decided what they don't want, they get bundled off and sent off to places like Togo, Tanzania. There was a really interesting book called The Travels of a T-Shirt in the Global Economy. And we talked about cotton earlier and all of the sort of unfair labor practices in the yeah. cotton industry. And then you talk about the production of textiles in different parts of the world. And it's a big industry in a lot of Africa. I think it's maybe second or third biggest industry in many countries. And you get these big bales of secondhand clothes, and then people go through them, and you bid on different items. And so in the far north, you tended to get things that would keep you protected from the sun but not very fashionable. In the capital city, where there are a lot of connections to France and the United States, people would get through, and they'd find all the, you know, the Izod tea, you know, polo shirts and things. And so, you know, as it gets further out into rural areas, it's more functional. But if you get into the bigger cities, it's you know, people have a pretty good eye for fashion. So you'll see people dressed pretty darn well.
When I watch a television report on somebody, the queen, princess or whatever of England
right.
is going to Togo or mm-hmm. someplace in the right. world, and it always shows little children and they're there to help,
mm-hmm.
I always look at what they're wearing and what T-shirts particularly that they're wearing.
Right.
And I often wondered if I'll ever find a KYMN radio T-shirt on somebody.
Well, if you want me to, I'll bring one over next time, and then you'll be sure to find one.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be like the Northfield News, where you go and you take your picture with the Northfield News
yeah,
in front of
it. Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay. The closest thing that we ever had was a KYMN bumper sticker
sure.
on a tank during the Desert Storm. And I thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
We will take one last break, and then we'll be back and wrap things up for today. And you ever have a hard time finding the arrow when you're using your mouse?
Oh, every time.
Okay. There it is.
Hi, I'm Angie Taylor, Director of Life Enrichment at Three Links Care Center in Northfield. We offer daily activities at each of our facilities, including independent senior living, assisted living, care center, and memory care. The activities range from exercise classes to sing-alongs, games to gardening, from bus rides in the countryside to painting fine art. Activities are personalized for the individual. Please call Three Links at 664-8800 or find out more at threelinks.org.
I'm Priya, and I'm part of the amazing community at CrossFit Scopos. I found myself getting bored with my usual gym routine. That's when I found CrossFit Scopos, a functional group fitness methodology dedicated to making you move better. You'll never be bored with a new workout every day planned by one of our fantastic coaches. CrossFit Scopos is for everybody. We don't throw tires. This community is inclusive and fun, and the workouts are making me stronger. I love this gym, and I guarantee you will too. Stop by anytime. We're located in Dundas off Highway 3 next to Menards.
All right. Thank you for that message. Speaking about messages, we were talking with our guest here on KYMN Radio about the fact that he is married to a Togoist, Togoian, Togogian. How do you?
Togolese
woman. And he said that just moments ago that he had two ceremonies, one in Togo, which was a traditional, colorful mm-hmm. three-day event with food. And then here in the United States, a minister
a civil,
or judge,
civil,
a civil
said, yeah, justice of the peace.
Okay, but then
We had another wedding the year after when my mother and father came back from California.
Yeah.
In the little Episcopal church where I grew up in Missouri. It was a pretty small, beautiful little church called Trinity.
Now, did you call people in?
We had some people in.
I mean, it was like a regular wedding where you have a reception and all that?
Kind of, but we didn't do it. We did wedding pictures. One of my old classmates from Kirksville High School had a Photoshop, and so we got him to do some nice pictures in Kirksville.
But were you do it in the typical dress and suit?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, I wore a suit, and she wore some nice things. That was the third wedding. Then we went for about 15 years thinking we were married, but when we got to Northfield, Father Frank Fried, I think somehow she let it slip that we were married in the Episcopal Church, and he said, "Well, that doesn't really count. So you shouldn't be one of the communion ministers because you're not really married." And so we did a nice blessing of an Episcopal wedding at St. Dominic's, and I think Jim Blaha of Northfield Community Action Center fame was kind enough to be my best man for that 1 hour or 20-minute wedding.
Did you invite people to it?
No, we invited ourselves.
But Father Frank, I think we might have, really, was he sincere?
He said, those are really nice, but they don't count.
Okay.
And I'm not Catholic, but I certainly wanted to respect my wife's traditions.
Isn't Long Catholic?
Yeah, she's very...
Oh.
She got a full scholarship from the Catholic school in Dapong that saved her from being married off as a child bride at the age of 14. So I think she feels a really strong...
Well, that's a big
Feels a strong debt to the Catholic Church and to the school that she went to. And she's got a nonprofit, a 501c3, called the Friends of Collège Monfant that does annual galas and really has done a lot to help the school. So I think that's her giving back for...
St. Dominic's.
Well, it's the school in Togo is called...
Oh, Togo. Okay.
It's called Collège Monfant. It was set up so that 14-year-old girls wouldn't be married off but could actually continue their studies with a boarding school so that the families would know that they were safe and then finish up junior high. And by that time, they're old enough to go on to high school and often to university. So there are quite a few of the graduates of that school who are now... You know, doctors and lawyers and writers, and one of them was minister of women condition in Togo. So I think it's
well. I just recently learned that there is a situation here in America where men in their 40s are marrying 14-year-old, 13-year-old, even 12-year-old girls, all under 18, all underage, illegal in Minnesota,
of course,
most states. Yeah. However, it's okay for them to marry these
child brides, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And then actually bring them back to America, and it's sanctioned by the United States as a legal marriage to a 14-year-old by a 48-year-old guy. And it's a sex trade, basically. And
sounds scary.
And Congress doesn't do anything about that.
Yeah, that.
So.
That's probably the subject for at least a good 10-hour special sometime in the future.
Yeah,
but
I'll tell you.
There are issues with traditional wedding practices when you come to the United States. I mean, in the American West, there was polygamy, right, for quite some time, and then that became outlawed. But, you know, there are a lot of different things going on. I mean,
do you think that's okay?
Polygamy? No, I'm not advocating for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't talk religion or politics.
Right, right.
And, because that's your business. In my
right, no, I'm not opinion. I'm not advocating for polygamy.
I know that. Yeah. You want to say it one more time for sure?
Yeah.
I don't advocate for
polygamy. Just in case I run for office someday, I'd like to make that clear.
Oh, okay. Right. You know, that keeps a lot of good people out of politics, the way they play it nowadays.
Right, right, yeah.
Scary.
Well, they say... Power corrupts, and so I think when people become very, very important, they lose a little bit of their grounding.
How does that full quote go about power?
Well, it depends on whether you want the Spider-Man version, you know, that with great power comes great responsibility, or is it absolute power corrupts absolutely? But I don't remember who said that, but I know it seems to sometimes be true.
Yeah, absolutely. 1 minute before 11 o'clock on KYMN Radio, we got you as far as getting your master's degree and living in Chicago.
Right, right.
And working at Northwestern.
Sure.
And then we got to get you to Northfield.
That'd be a nice place to go.
Yeah. And what years were those that you and Noi Long lived in the area of Northwestern?
Well, we were there from 1986 to 89, and she began her nursing studies, but she had to start out with English as a second language and things like that.
She'd be interesting to interview.
Yeah, no, much more interesting than me, I think.
Well, I think
all
so
my
too.
Friends agree, but she, but she actually did ESL and her GED because her college degree didn't transfer. Then we got a Fulbright, and so I got a Fulbright and went back for 2 years to Togo from 89 to 91.
A Fulbright.
Fulbright was to do research for the doctorate. No. On borderland communities between Togo and Ghana.
You're going for another doctorate?
Oh, that would be... No, this was the doctorate.
The same one?
This is the same one. I just didn't finish it.
All right. So next time we visit...